Blog Talk Radio.
3, 2, 1. How are people with disabilities showcased on television? Turner Classic Movies contributes some answers with the Projected Image, a month-long film festival where disability is front and center. Lawrence Carter Long curated and co-hosts this effort. Christine Bruno pushes for greater TV representation as advocate with inclusion in the arts. Both joining me next. History Channel continues its miniseries role Tuesday night with The Man Who Built America, a nonfiction study of notable achievers. The Phil Wiggles ahead with executive producer Stephen David. Also going up, Maine and Jersey's gone, and what new fall season series are on the chopping block? Plus the answer to our classic trivia question of the week. Hello everyone, I'm Simon Applebaum, live from New York on Block Talk Radio. This just in, tomorrow will be televised. Great to have you with us. 60 degrees at the top of the hour. We have a terrific hour in store for you on this October Friday, and we invite you to be part of the program. Give us a call with your questions or comments to any of our guests at 1-646-652-2906. That's 1-646-652-2906. The number today, we are catching us live on Block Talk Radio. Another way to get involved, our chat room, SimonApple045A. We already have a bunch of people in the room, like guests 2258 and 2321. So either way, join our chat room. We want to hear from you. And while the program is on the air, you can share it with others you know simply by using Facebook Timeline. Click on the banner at the top of the Block Talk Radio screen, follow the instructions, and other people can hear this show with you right now. Our first guest from New York and Washington, D.C., join us after these news notes. Don't look for Maine and Jersey on CBS tonight or ever again. Maine gave the first new series casualty of the still young 2012-13 season earlier this week. Unless ratings improve, cut by DVR after views, at least one more rookie program may exit by this time next Friday. The chopping block candidates, according to industry critics and analysts, 666 Park Avenue on ABC, Partners on CBS, Fox is the Mock Doctor, and NBC's Animal Practice. And former CBS's morning co-host Erica Hill has left CBS, according to the Hollywood Reporter. Next for her, co-anchoring Weekend Today on NBC, alongside Lester Holt. The worst is now from Ether Network. And that's our news notes for now. All month long, Turner Classic Movies is offering one of its unique film festivals. They've been doing this kind of festival for the last few years, showcasing how people like Arab Americans, Asian Americans, Latinos, African Americans, the gay lesbian community have been impacted and portrayed by motion pictures throughout time. Now is the turn of people with disability in The Projected Image, A History of Disability in Film. The program runs Tuesday night starting at 8 p.m. Eastern Pacific Time on Turner Classic Movies. Joining us live from Washington, D.C., one of the foremost experts on the media and disability, he is the creator and the co-host of Ben Mankiewicz of The Projected Image, Lawrence Carter. Lawrence, good to have you.
Thank you, Simon. It's a pleasure to be here with you.
And rejoining me here in New York, we had her on before, the disability advocate for inclusion in the arts, Christine Bruno. Christine, welcome back.
Hi, Simon. Thanks for having me back.
When Christine was on the show, Lawrence, 7 weeks back, we talked to her about how people with disabilities are represented on television. How do you think they are represented on TV?
Well, pretty much the way they've been represented on TV is the same way they've been played in movies. You tend to get these very narrow stereotypes where it's either a very tragic story where someone has obstacles to overcome, or you get sort of the super cripple story. Once one has overcome those obstacles, you get the Rocky music and you get the expectations of, you know, anybody that sort of wakes up in the morning or gets on with their life is somehow heroic. They've also, I think, in past times, portrayed people with disabilities as outsiders, people on the outskirts of society, not really involved in, you know, the other things that folks tend to take for granted, going to work, having a love life, getting an education, things like that. So those are things we're starting to see change, and I know that's what groups like Inclusion in the Arts is working to change as well.
Christine, have you seen any developments over the first 2 weeks of television season? I know that yesterday the New York Post reported that HBO is auditioning amputees for a key scene next year on Game of Thrones.
Yes, I saw that as well. Of course, yes, we know Peter Dinklage has had great success with Game of Thrones, so that's been great. We have seen a couple of things. I think most notably on this season, Sons of Anarchy, there's a recurring character who is an actor who is an amputee named Kurt Yeager. So, and he'll be a recurring on Sons of Anarchy this season, which is fabulous. Also, there's Ryan Murphy's new show, The New Normal, which I know he, on the pilot episode, had three people with disabilities, a little person and two deaf actors. So, you know, we're starting to see a bit, but obviously, as we know, we still have a long way to go.
And we should point out, Switched at Birth continues on ABC Family. It's still in its first expanded season. Second season begins in January. And I understand Sesame Street may have done an episode today, which was in honor of, I think it's National Disability Awareness Month and National Blind Awareness Month.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, you can almost pick your disability and what you want people to become more aware of in October, and almost everybody has kind of thrown their hat into the ring at this point.
Yeah.
Lawrence, what's been the reaction so far to the projected image? It's 2 weeks in, continues the rest of October on Tuesday nights. What's been the audience reaction?
It's been fantastic. Really overwhelmingly positive. I can't say, you know, it's exceeded even my expectations, which tend to be pretty high. We've been doing live tweeting and chats with people during the first couple of movies each night. Enthusiastic reaction across the board. I think for a couple of reasons. One, people are recognizing now that disability is not just subject matter. It's not just something that you write the story about it and an actor might portray someone with a disability to get an award. But now they're realizing that there are audiences out there, folks who have disabilities, and they're catering to them. You know, for the first time that I've ever seen in the industry, Turner Classic Movies is not only presenting these films as a part of history and putting them in social and historical context, but also making sure that every film is captioned and gives is audio described so that people who have visual impairments and people who are deaf can enjoy the films right there along with their non-disabled peers. That's a first. If you start thinking about the saturation and the reach of a network like TCM, you're talking about 87 million households, and that's really not been done before. So I think both in terms of subject matter and in terms of audience, it's really unprecedented.
Absolutely.
Lawrence, how long had Turner Classic Movies been thinking about doing a festival like this, and how did you get involved in the project, and what role did you have in selecting the films?
Well, I curated the film festival, so I selected all the films. It was a painful process. The initial list that I had about 150 movies, and we had to whittle that down to 21. This whole project began because of the work of folks at Inclusion in the Arts. Cindy Gordon, who does the media and communications over there, had noticed that Turner had done fantastic programs in the past on other identity groups, including Arab Americans, Latinos, LGBT, and they hadn't done disability yet. And she came to me and said, hey, what do you think about approaching Turner and suggesting that they do a program on disabilities? We did that, and Turner was on board immediately. They said, absolutely, this is something that we need to do. And then they asked me, because of my background in media, particularly in film, to help curate the series. And that began just a little bit over a year, about a year ago.
There are some films that are probably easy to select, like The Best Years of Our Lives, which was on this past Tuesday. I think one of the 10 best films I've ever seen, and still very, very powerful, or films like I Care to Remember with Cary Grant and Deborah Kerr. But there's a lot of movies in this festival that people do not know about that were pretty groundbreaking in their day.
Yeah, and we did that on purpose. You know, there's some films that almost that you have to show, right, because of their historical significance. You mentioned a couple of the Best Years of Our Lives, things like The Miracle Worker or Johnny Belinda, because of the awards that they've received, or something like One Flew Over the Cuckoo's Nest. But we also recognize, because of Turner's library and the deep bench that they have, that we had an opportunity to bring some films right into people's living rooms that they haven't had a chance to see. One of those films was from 1929, a film called Lucky Star that we kicked off last Tuesday's evening with, which featured a very young Janet Gaynor, and talked about a returning World War I veteran who was a wheelchair user, and some of the conventions and some of the things that are now cliched, you know, 80 years later, were not at the time. And so you got a chance to see how those things kind of evolved. Some other things we showed, a film called Sign of the Ram from 1948. It stars an actress named Susan Peters, who became a paraplegic as a result of a gunshot accident. And the studio liked her so much that they said, we're going to create this vehicle for you using her wheelchair, and she's literally hell on wheels in this thing. She's like Joan Crawford, who's you know, just basically doing up the scenery. It's a bravura performance from 1948 that people haven't had a chance to see because it's never been released on DVD. And you have to ask yourself the question, if Hollywood could create a role for a disabled actress in 1948, why aren't they doing more of that now?
And here's something interesting for both of you. When I looked it up on Wikipedia about Sign of the Rain, that the woman who portrayed that character later, a couple of years later, in fact, did a television series. It was an eight-time series called Miss Susan on NBC, sponsored by Colgate. It ran the better part of a year. It was canceled by the sponsor at the end of the year. But she made history in a way as being the first paraplegic to headline her own television series.
That's right. One of the soap operas back in, you know, back in the early days of the networks.
That's it.
I'm sorry. Go ahead, Christine.
Say that again, Simon.
I mean, go ahead. I was interrupting somebody.
No, I just was saying that that's it. That was the very, very early days of television, and I don't know for sure, but I would posit that that was probably one of the first, if not the first, soap operas. So.
Yeah, it was back in the day when soap operas were on for 15 minutes, and the sponsorship was you know, done by, you know, companies like Colgate and Palmolive. That's where they got the soap opera designation, and it was, you know, really unheard of. I think it is a testament both to her talents and how much she was beloved by the industry and within you know, sort of entertainment, that they gave her that opportunity. That series was started in 1951, went under a couple of different names, I believe, in its time. One of the names was, it was Miss Susan was the original title, and later it was called Martinsville, USA. And it was, you know, it was Susan Peters. She started as the character, I think, was called Susan Martin, and it was her involvement of the people around her, and indeed the man that she loves, and her housekeeper. So, you know, the common conventions that you see right there within most soap operas, but really centering on a real live wheelchair user. She was a lawyer too. That's another thing that I wanted to really bring up, is that she had a career and that she was working. She was a wheelchair user who was a lawyer, and you know, centered on her life and her loves back in 1951.
I actually wanted to go back to something that you, Lawrence, and you, Simon, both said about the selection of the films for TCM. It's interesting that a lot of the films are ones that we're familiar with, but the thing that's fascinating to me is I think that a lot of people who may have seen The Best Years of Our Lives and One Flew Over the Cuckoo's Nest may not think of them in a context of disability necessarily. And so I think to put them in a series like this that shows the history of disability on film allows people to see these films that they've grown up with and that are much beloved in through a different lens, as it were.
Yeah, what we really wanted to do was to show you those films that you think you know, that you think you understand already, but show it to you in a whole new light. You know, and when you present them together, when you've got all these movies from the silent era up through just before the Americans with Disabilities Act was passed, they really show a trajectory and they show a history that if you view these films in isolation, you don't really get to see. But you put them together and you start looking at how the trends, you know, in society, the changes in the culture were reflected back in the films that we saw, and the things that we saw in the films were reflected back in society, how that we saw how they interwove and how they really worked with each other and informed the changes that occurred both in the movies and in our lives. Everything you think you know sort of takes a whole new depth and a whole new wrinkle when you start to look at them together. And we wanted to give people a chance to do that and to have the discussion about it. You know, not only just watch the films, but having Ben Mankiewicz and myself introducing and doing the outros of the films, having the folks that we had doing the interstitials and the promos in between the films that will be airing all month, people like Linda Bove, who was groundbreaking in her role on Sesame Street, which began in the 1970s. People like Marlee Matlin, you know, who people know from Children of a Lesser God and The L Word. people like Kurt Yeager, who Christine talked about earlier, who's now in Sons of Anarchy, Robert David Hall, who can be seen every week on CSI, Danny Woodburn, who was seen on the Seinfeld TV series, who's a little person. So you've got all these folks doing the interstitials, giving each one of these films more context, more credit. People like Jerry Jewell that was involved in the interstitials and talking about the work that she did in TV and the films that she saw growing up and how that kind of influenced her work and her career, I think give this a depth that people haven't usually been exposed to before.
Absolutely.
The Projected Image, a history of disability film, is running Tuesday night on Turner Classic Movies, 8 p.m. Eastern Pacific Time. And joining us today, this half hour on Tomorrow, we'll be televised Lawrence Carter Long, who is the creator and co-host of The Projected Image, and Christine Bruno from Inclusion of the Arts. We invite you to be part of the program here on Tomorrow Be Televised. Happy to have you aboard on Block Talk Radio. Simon Applebaum live from New York. Lawrence joining us from D.C. Christine in New York as well. If you have a question or comment, don't be silent. Give the call at 1-646-652-2906. That's 1-646-652-2906. Or use our chat room, Simon Apple 04 by name. Lawrence, was there a particular movie that we don't know a lot about that you were hoping
anyone
got in this festival?
Well, one of them we spoke about earlier was Sign of the Ram. I think people really needed a chance and deserved a chance to see that film. It deserves its due. That was a film that was sort of brought to me by a woman named Jenny Gold, who's directing a film about depictions of disability in cinema called Cinemability that's just had its premiere out in Burbank just a few weeks ago. There are other films like Gabby, A True Story, which was done in 1987. That was 2 years before My Left Foot came out. It's the true story of a woman with cerebral palsy named Gabrielle Brimmer and how she fought to get sort of independence and to get a proper education and indeed her love life. I think that's significant because it covers a lot of the ground that we did see later in My Left Foot, but it's a disabled woman. And it's never been released on DVD, so people haven't had a chance to see that before. Film coming up in a couple of weeks on October 23rd is A Child is Waiting, starring Burt Lancaster and Judy Garland, which is a fantastic film directed by John Cassavetes. Again, it covers much the same ground that we're dealing with today in terms of fighting policies and budgets. It's about the education of a young disabled man who we label today as autistic. 1963, this film was made. Many of the same themes we're seeing in states across the U.S. today. Judy Garland, Burt Lancaster, two of their best performances. People haven't had a chance to see it, so we wanted to put it right into people's living rooms. And I think it also gives us a chance to sort of deconstruct and reconstruct films that people might have seen in another context. Films like 1932's Freaks by Todd Browning, mm-hmm. people might have thought it was a horror movie, but never quite thought of as a disability film before. And if we're looking at, you know, the trends these days, where we're moving away from hiring non-disabled actors to play disabled characters, probably the first place you ever saw disabled people play disabled people was in a film like Freaks,
yeah.
and that was done way back in 1932. So when you've got people, performers with disabilities from Coney Island, California, getting tattoos that say one of us in solidarity, both with sort of the themes that you see in Freaks and the revisioning and the reclamation of that term today, it certainly has its place in the history, and we wanted to give it a spotlight as well.
Lawrence, I'm happy you brought Child is Waiting up because I have admired that film for a long time. It's going to be leading off the festival on the 23rd. And the film was very controversial, both for subject matter and also because there was a disagreement between the director, John Cassavetes, and the producer, who is very known for his work with social issues in film, Stanley Kramer.
Mm-hmm.
Kramer wanted the treatment of the mentally challenged a certain way. Cassavetes really fell in love with a number of actually mentally challenged people who were in, mentally challenged kids were in the film. He felt that the film should showcase the fact that, hey, these people should be on their own, be allowed to live whichever way they want to, not be institutionalized. Kramer wanted to felt it should be an institutional thing, although with more freedom, not to be sort of rich and strict, and it was because of that that Cassavetes decided at the end, I'm not going to do the Hollywood studio system anymore, and that's when he became a major independent filmmaker for life.
That's right. So beyond the disability themes, you know, films of fans of films and fans of cinema, certainly folks who know Cassavetes and are interested in just the pantheon of films that he's put together, this will be of interest to them as well. I think, you know, the style that he brought to it, even the fact that he and Kramer butted heads, you know, Cassavetes at the end considered this, because of the cut and some of the edits that were made, more Stanley Kramer's film than his film. But I think people deserve a chance to see it, see those hints of Cassavetes that are all throughout it, and decide for themselves, you know, what film they would have liked to have seen, what it might have been if they'd left Cassavetes alone.
And I'll tell you, the children in that film are remarkable, both the actual mentally challenged children in the film, and also a very young actor named Bruce Ritchie, whose performance is highly underrated. It's one of the great child performances you'll ever see, and I do agree with that. I think Judy Garland and Burt Lancaster give two of their best performances in this movie. Great script by Eddie Mann as well, I should point out. And also, that night, two other films I really enjoy. One is Of Mice and Men. If you think you know Lon Chaney Jr. from all those horror movies, from The Wolfman on down, wait till you see this performance. It is a great performance and a brilliant musical score by Aaron Copland, great director by Louis Milestone. And at 2 a.m., I think it's a terrific performance. Cliff Robertson is Charlie. You may not like the film, but I think the performance by Cliff Robertson is really something to admire. And a great music score by Ravi Shankar, one of the very few made for film.
And you got to know that, you know, when it comes to a film like Charlie, it never would have gotten made without Cliff
Robertson.
He opted, you know, he bought the rights early on and really saw this thing through. And it's not only worthy and notable because of his performance, which is something to see, but also because of the themes that are addressed in the movie. You know, some of the things that we saw much later in films like Awakening, with Robin Williams and Robert De Niro, are sort of touched upon in here, which is where do science and ethics kind of intersect? And so they you know, perform a procedure that allows an intellectually disabled man to IQ to increase, and he starts to question what are the ethics of this when he realizes he's become a lab rat. I won't get into the spoilers at the end of this thing, but it's something to behold, and I think it raises a lot of questions that hadn't been raised before back when it was made in 1968. When you think about a film like Of Mice and Men, and you think about Steinbeck, and you think about the history of that, and recognizing that you know, some of the themes and some of the ideas that center around that book, around people with intellectual disabilities being dangerous, and the fact that Steinbeck's book was used and the film was used in an attempt to justify an execution of an intellectually disabled man just back in July in Texas. You know that the themes, the ideas that are in these classic films and the works that went into creating them are still with us today and really deserve a first, if not a second or a third look. It's one of those things that never gets old and always remains timeless.
And one thing, Lawrence, by the way, with Charlie that many people may not know is there was a lot of television involved with this. Robertson had done a dramatic special called The Two Worlds of Charlie Gordon based on the famous book Flowers for Algernon by Daniel Keyes. And he got the rights to do it as a movie. And the executive producer of Charlie was Salih Seligman of Selma Productions, who created Combat. And one of the first few films that man did. And so you got to give Salih credit for trusting the material and Robertson. And, of course, Robertson won the Academy Award the year it was released for Best Picture. The projected image of history of disability in film, Turner Classic Movies, all October long, Tuesday night, starting at 8 p.m. Eastern Pacific Time. Lawrence Carter Long, Christy Bruno, joining us, involved with this festival. Lawrence Carter Long, the creator, and co-host of the Festival Event Banquet. Christy Bruno from Inclusion in the Arts, involved with the project. They're both with us this half hour on Smarty Televike. Happy to be with us too. Simon Applebaum live from New York on Blog Talk Radio. Be in the conversation. Give us a call at 1-646-652-2906. We'll have Lawrence and Christine on for another couple minutes. You'll also have our chat room to work with, Simon Apple 04 by name. Welcome guests 2372 and 2302 of the room. Coming up our next half hour, History Channel, new miniseries, The Man Who Builds America, premieres Tuesday night. We'll have the executive producer, Stephen David. He's got some other interesting projects up his sleeve for the rest of this year and next as well. With this project, Christine, was there a particular movie you didn't know about that really surprised you?
You know, to be honest, I've seen most of these films, but Lawrence is, you know, he really is the the aficionado of anything disability and film related. So there were a couple that I hadn't seen. I think I'd not seen 23 Paces to Baker Street, which I won't give away because we haven't seen it yet, which airs on Tuesday, the 16th. And I had not seen Sign of the Ram, which I was amazed by. And I didn't know about the Susan Peters story, I'm ashamed to admit. So there are definitely some gems in here that I had not seen. And I'm particularly appreciating the opportunity to sort of watch these films week by week in their particular groupings and revisit them in a way that I hadn't before. I mean, being a person with a disability my whole life and being an artist with a disability, I've seen many of these films many times because I've been an actor for a long time and a student of film history for a long time. But, of course, when I saw One Flew Over the Cuckoo's Nest in 1975, I wasn't thinking about necessarily about the disability angle of it, you know. I of course, films like The Miracle Worker, I was thinking about the disability angle of it, but not necessarily about the history of disability or the portrayal of disability. So it's fascinating for me as an adult and as an artist with a disability to also look at these films in a different way that I haven't in many years.
Coming up on next Tuesday's festival is Johnny Belinda. That's the Jane Wyman movie. She won the Oscar for playing a deaf, mute person who has to deal with life as it comes to her. And in some of the interstitials for the projected image, which are being showcased throughout the day on Turner Classic Movies, in this particular one, the actors who are presented in the interstitial are very, very frank about their feelings about Johnny Belinda, and they think it's not that great a movie.
Well, I think what they're able to do, because of the lived experience, is to point out some of the inconsistencies on the film. You know, while the film was one of the first, certainly Wyman did a lot of work in learning sign language. It was one of the first films to offer and to show somebody doing sign language but having a voiceover at the same time for those who are ASL impaired so they could enjoy the film as well. So it was groundbreaking in some of those ways, but they also missed out a lot. And this is what happens when you have, you know, non-disabled directors, non-disabled writers, non-disabled actors who wouldn't have had that lived experiences trying to translate that for general audiences. You know, one of the things that happened is when Jane Wyman's character is attacked, when her child is taken away, Linda Bogue says in the interstitial that it's like her mouth has been sewn shut, that she doesn't utter a sound throughout the course of this film, and that's just unrealistic. Mm-hmm. Anybody who encounters everything that this woman encounters in this film, and I don't want to give too much away, well, would be certainly screaming, scratching, squalling, wailing, making a fuss all across the board. You don't see it. She's literally been rendered sort of silent through the course of the film, and anybody who's deaf who watches that would say, wait a minute, that's not realistic and that's not reflective of my life. So even with the best of intentions, if it's not informed by somebody who has that lived experience, who can give it that kind of depth, who can give it that kind of insight that you see when you involve disabled performers and creative folks who have disabilities, you're going to miss out on some pretty important things. And I think what the projected image shows is that those hopes we have about disability, about people being heroic, or those fears we have about disability being tragic, get projected onto the characters that we see on screen, and they get reflected back at us as a society. So it's a chance to kind of look at that, to, again, as Christine said so well, revisit films that we think we know, look at it through a whole new lens, and then reconsider both where we've been, where we are now, and where we should be going in the future.
Go ahead, Christine.
I was just going to add to that about Johnny Belinda in particular, and this is my own personal feeling about it, is I remember very clearly the first time that I saw that film thinking, you know, and I was young, I think I was a teenager, and thinking there's something about this film that doesn't ring true to me. And it wasn't because, you know, I'm not deaf, so I don't have the lived experience of what it's like to be deaf. But speaking to Lawrence's point about what Linda said about reacting, I thought it was very strange that this woman as a human being would not be reacting to anything that was going on around her. And even as a teenager, I felt that there's something really, really inauthentic about this, and I couldn't put my finger on what it was. And I think that Linda's absolutely right, that sometimes with film and with television, I think everything is, most things are seen through a non-disabled person's lens, and the disabled person is sort of run through this mill of inauthenticity and inaccuracy and sort of what they want the disabled person to, the symbolism of what the disabled person is. So it makes disabled people generic and less than in a way that's even less than what most people perceive disabilities, people with disabilities to be like. That was a little convoluted, but my point is she didn't even seem like a real human being, let alone a human being with a disability to me in that particular film.
Lawrence, before we go, I wanted to ask you about Best Years of Our Lives, and especially a very important scene in that film where Harold Russell, playing Homer, takes off his hooks. Do you believe it's one of the great groundbreaking moments in all of film history?
That's a fantastic, it's a fantastic scene, it's a fantastic film. I've probably watched it four or five times here in the last year as we've been preparing for the series. And what's remarkable about that film, in addition to what you're saying, where it actually, you know, it was originally written, it was written for somebody who'd had a brain injury, what we might have called shell shock back in the day, or we would call TBI or PTSD. These days, that when they saw Harold Russell, who was at a training film for returning veterans on going back to work, the director, William Wyler, said, I like this guy so much. He's got this sort of genuine quality about him. He didn't want Russell to take any acting classes. He just kind of wanted to put him out there on screen. They rewrote that script to include Harold Russell, and I think to really use his unique physicality. And they also showcased that. They showcased him, you know, lighting cigarettes, opening a beer, having an ice cream sundae, normalizing disability in a way that we hadn't seen in cinema before, just having it throughout, him doing everyday normal things, cleaning his gun inside the garage that folks had not been introduced to before. And I think that helped audiences empathize with the character. I think it helped them identify with the character and sort of take it to a whole new level that we really hadn't seen before, particularly in mainstream cinema up until that day. And, you know, what's really sad about that situation, too, is that Russell only worked a couple of more times throughout the course of his life. He didn't work again. He wasn't in another film until 1980 in doing Inside Moves. And he did sort of a B-horror movie after that, and he was in one episode of Trapper John M.D., on the CBS network. That's the only acting the guy did, because even though he broke new ground, he was the first to get two Oscars, you know, an Oscar for Best Supporting Actor and an Oscar for being an inspiration to returning veterans, and yet beyond that role, casting directors couldn't figure out ways, weren't inventive enough, creative enough, or open-minded enough to kind of look beyond sort of what they had projected onto him, to give him more opportunities to act. So I think it's both a triumph in some ways in its depiction and Wyler sort of adapting that role for him, but it also shows the failure of Hollywood
to move
beyond where they were stuck and to give actors like Russell more opportunities to show their stuff.
And how funny that, you know, Russell received two Oscars for that role in 1946, and the next person to receive an Oscar for a film was 40 years later, was Marley Matlin in 1986, the next PWD to receive an Oscar. So that to me is a huge...
And Marley, of course, is on Switched at Birth.
Yes, absolutely. Well, Marley's a great example of somebody who's really done exactly what we're all advocating for, is a person with a disability who has played both disability-specific roles and made a career playing non-specific roles.
I think we've reached a point in the culture, and this is reflective of TCM doing the series, where we no longer have to be ashamed of our disabilities, we no longer have to hide them, we don't have to put a spotlight on them and make them the only focus of the story either. I think we're at a stage now where people can see the person and the disability. They can kind of incorporate that into the role, where so you've got the disabled character who's not only focusing on the fact that they have a disability, but they can be the guy next door, they can be the love interest, they can be the person standing behind you in line or eating at the table next to you in the restaurant, where you're seeing disability as sort of the overall fabric, the tapestry of our day-to-day lives in ways that you hadn't seen before. And I think Marley's career is reflective of that.
Absolutely.
I wish we could continue this dialogue because it is very important and involves a very important element of society. But the dialogue will continue this Tuesday night, 8 p.m. Pacific time, when Turner Classic Movie resumes its month-long festival, The Projected Image, A History of Disability in Film. It is a festival well worth catching all October long, Tuesday night, 8 p.m. Eastern Pacific Time on Turner Classic Movies. Check your local listing for TCM is available in your area on cable and satellite. For more details online, two places, www.tcn.com. And to find out more about inclusion in the arts and what Christine's organization is up to, whether it's television or other forms of media, here's where you go, www.inclusioninthearts.org. It's www.inclusioninthearts.org. Laura Carter-Long, Christine Brito, thank you both very much for being with us. Congratulations on the festival, and we hope to resume this dialogue very, very soon with both of you.
Thank you,
Thanks,
Simon.
Much. Thank you, Simon. Stay tuned, everybody. We've got 3 great weeks to go.
You got it. Take care. Have a wonderful weekend.
You too.
So long.
Christine Brito joining us live from New York. Laura Carter-Long joining us live from Washington, D.C. this Friday afternoon on Tomorrow Will Be Televised. When we come back, here's Rochelle Du Miniseries, The Men Who Built America. Executive producer Stephen David joins me live here in New York after we cross the bottom of the hour for web identification. You are connected to the Internet Radio Zone, www.blogtalkradio.com, more than 9 million listeners around the world every month and growing. Your home for Call of Duty's E-Buzz with New York One anchor Cheryl Willis. Catch Cheryl and other guests on Call of Duty's E-Buzz tonight, 9 a.m. Eastern, 6 p.m. Pacific, right here on Blog Talk Radio. Welcome back in the second half of Tomorrow We Televise. I'm Adam Lammy with you live from New York. Happy to have you aboard this Friday afternoon. Great guests coming away in the next half hour. So give us a call at 1-646-652-2906. That's 1-646-652-2906. No one's going anywhere to catch you live on Blog Talk Radio. Sharon Wolf as well, sign at 04 by name. We welcome guests 2460-2479 in the room, as well as you. So use the phone, use the chat room. Either way, want to hear from you. Before we do, we want to give the answer to our classic 3D trivia question of the week, which we posed on Monday. The question, Dayton, Ohio gave birth to what classic daytime series? Dayton, Ohio gave birth to what classic daytime series? That series lasted more than 20 years, and it was The Phil Donahue Show, which ran from 1967 to 1996. And that's our answer. So congratulate everybody who thought of the question. Try to get the answer. And if you'd like to participate, we have another question for you on Monday. If you know the answer, or if you have a question you'd like to stump our Blog Talk Radio listeners with, email me at simonapple04@yahoo.com. That's simonapple04@yahoo.com. If we use your classic trivia question, or you answer ours, and the first one to do so, we'll give you credit on next Friday's program. So get involved, simonapple04@yahoo.com. simonapple04@yahoo.com. Coming up Monday on Tomorrow We Televise, many additions for you. First of all, rescheduled from a week ago, David Hegeberg, the host, creator, and executive producer of Sundance Channel's The Mortify Session. Then we'll have the co-creators of the popular police drama Flashpoint on CBS and on television, Stephanie Morgenstern and Mark Ellis, Helena Martinez. And finally, we'll have the writer and director of HBO's upcoming original movie about the strange relationship between film director Alfred Hitchcock and actress Tippi Hedren on and off the set of The Birds and Marty. The film is called The Girl. We'll have the writer, Gwyneth Hughes, and the director, Julian Jarrett, live from London next Friday, right here. Next Monday, right here. On Tomorrow We Televise. Next Friday, among my guests, we'll have one of the producers of the new Scott Bakel sitcom on Nick at Night, Speed Dad Run. That's next Monday and Friday, 3 p.m. Eastern, New Pacific, right here on Blog Talk Radio. It's been a big year for the History Channel. Shows like Porn Stars, and American Restoration, and American Papers continue. And recently, 2 Emmy Awards in acting for the miniseries The Hatfields and McCoys, the largest miniseries in the history in terms of viewership of cable television. Winning awards for Kevin Costner and Tom Berenger. The next mini-series on History Channel's agenda, The Man Who Built America, premieres Tuesday night at 9 a.m. Eastern Pacific Time.
Hello.
Joining me live here in New York, executive producer Stephen David. Stephen, thanks for being with us.
Hi, thanks for having me on.
Why did you decide to showcase The Man Who Built America?
When did I decide, or, sorry?
When and why?
Why? You know, I've always been fascinated by, the robber barons, and these men during this time. We really focus on the 50 years between the end of the Civil War and World War One, and it's an interesting time because it went from time when America was sort of broken and divided to when they became to when America became a superpower, and it was mainly done through these certain men who did good and bad things, but changed our country forever.
And who are those men, and how did you decide to pick these five or six?
We really focused on Cornelius Vanderbilt, John Rockefeller, Andrew Carnegie, J.P. Morgan, and Ford. There are other people within the show that we focus on some, which is Frick and Thomas Edison, Jay Gould, Jim Fisk, various others, but really tried to focus on the people that everyone knows these people's names, but they know very little about them. And what we really found interesting through our research was that they were really dealing with each other during this time. They weren't completely separate entities. They entered each other's worlds, and there sort of was this constant fight to see which one of them could be on top.
What made these men build America? What about their spirit or the inventions or the advancements they made in society? What about them were big players? What had them build America?
You know, it's something, as we've gone through the research of this, we have often thought that maybe the show should have been called The Men Whose Egos Inadvertently Built America. Because, we show they were all geniuses in one way or another, but we certainly show that a balanced view. I don't know that when they were doing what they were doing that ended up building America, that they were saying to themselves, this is going to build America. I think it's, what's been interesting about this show is there are many parallels to today. We often thought the tagline should just be history repeats itself, because even though they were all geniuses in their own way, they it wasn't a completely reverent endeavor or altruistic endeavor.
How long did it take you to put this mini-series together? And I understand there's a lot of computer graphic work in the film. I'm sure there's some recreations, too. How do you showcase not only these people, but also the times that they lived in, the times they impacted?
Yeah, we, as we got into this, we were trying to look for sort of a different way to do a documentary or docudrama that would make it as immersive as possible. I've made several documentaries. I like the genre. With this one in particular, the goal was to try and make it as immersive as possible. So we actually partnered with a company called Brainstorm Digital, who does the visual effects for the show Boardwalk Empire. And the idea was, instead of just doing a recreation, can we put our actors can we put these people in the historic events that actually we're talking about? So instead of just seeing an archived picture, can we see it? So, for example, there's a story about Carnegie building this first steel bridge in America that across the Mississippi, and we're able to actually have him with other actors in a scene, in a construction site scene of this bridge being built in 1868. And as you look at it, it just looks completely real. So we've done that throughout the project so that you are immersed in whatever history it is, whether it involves oil wells or trains, steel plants, electricity, the Panama Canal, anything we could do to make you feel what it was like to actually be in that time.
Stephen David is executive producer of The Men Who Built America, History Channel, the miniseries airing on that network Tuesday night at 9, 10 Eastern Pacific Time. Stephen joins me here in New York on Suave Televised this October Friday afternoon. I'm happy to have you aboard as well on Blog Talk Radio, Tom Applebaum, live from New York. Give your call, give us your thoughts at 1-646-652-2906. That's 1-646-652-2906. We're getting into our chat room. Let's get us 2460 and 2479 done. Either way, I want to hear from you because what you say matters. Once again, coming on our show Monday, David Engelberg from the Mortified Sense on Sunday's channel, the 101 team from Flashpoint, Stephanie Morgenstern and Mark Ellis, and the writer-director of the new HBO film on Alfred Hitchcock, The Girl. With you, the writer, Julian Jarrow, the director, live from London, Monday, 3:10 Eastern, 2 Pacific, right here on Blog Talk Radio. What was the most interesting revelation for you in putting this together?
I think that when we looked into the history and to see how few people have such a big effect on a whole country, and when I say that, I also talk about in the negative ways. We have a lot of CEOs and business people from today as interviews. One of them is Alan Greenspan. And there's a part where he's commenting on the similarity between the recession of 2008 and of 1873. And what's interesting is, you know, we all know about the housing bubble and how, you know, the housing bubble was caused by, or the financial crisis was caused by a few people. You look at what happened in 1873, and basically that was caused by a few people as well. It was basically a fight between Rockefeller, Vanderbilt, and the railroads, between railroads and oil, that, you know, triggered a depression. And I just think it's interesting that throughout time, throughout history, that you see that certain people either fighting with each other or getting along with each other can have such massive effects on a whole country.
Stephen, somewhere along the way, do you think you're going to get this comment, where are the women who built America? And what do you say to people who think that your program doesn't cover that? Or is that going to be a sequel, let's say, for an upcoming History Channel program?
I mean, I would love to do a sequel to this called The Women That Built America. This was something with the network to cover these men, but I have done quite a bit of research into women as well, and it would be another fascinating project to do. So if anybody out there wants to do it, I would love to do it.
Well, what did your research turn up? What about the role of women in shaping this country?
What about them?
Yeah.
I think we could do, you know, tons of research on it, but I think that it would be, you know, a good miniseries to do. I think, I'm sort of going through the history without being biased. I'm trying to let the viewer judge for themselves. I think, obviously, women have played an important part in American history, and I would love to be a part of telling that story.
I understand that you've done a lot of documentary programming for different networks, including History Channel. What keeps you doing that kind of work, being in that kind of genre? What about the genre? What about the kind of work you do keeps you going?
I think I just constantly find that the truth is stranger than fiction. And I love the storytelling part of it, but when you look into these true stories, there's just so many great stories of what really happened that I think if somebody made it up and told you, you wouldn't believe it. But when you look into it, and it actually is true, and what happened, especially when it has such wide-ranging effects, I just always find that fascinating. And I also find it fascinating the human nature behind these iconic events. I love to look into why people did what they did, what drove them to do that. You know, in this particular case, why did Rockefeller never have enough money? Why was it never enough for him? And with him in particular, we found that his father was called Devil Bill and was a con man that used to steal from Rockefeller himself as a child. And so there was this thing about him that he always felt that somebody was going to come take everything away from him. So it's an interesting, even when we did these interviews of these CEOs today, they all, Sumner Redstone or Mark Cuban or any of the other people we had, they never talked about the money. They always talked about the winning. They all wanted to win. That's what it's all about with them. And I just find it fascinating to just to see what the human side behind these true stories always are.
The Vanderbilt America premieres Tuesday night, 9:10 Eastern Pacific Time on History Channel. Stephen David is the executive producer of the series. He's also done some other work, which we'll talk about in a moment. We want to give you the opportunity to get involved in the program, so give us a call at 1-646-652-2906. That's 1-646-652-2906. So these are chat rooms, Simon Apple 04 by name. 2 weeks from today on this program, the man that brought us so many memorable hours of The X-Files, writer-producer Frank Sputnik, will be one of my special guests. He'll join us live from London, where he's doing a new series of Cinemax that he wrote and created. It's called Hunted. It stars Melissa George, who will premiere next week on Cinemax. Frank Sputnik of The X-Files, live with us 2 weeks from today, right here on Tomorrow Will Be Televised. Stephen, you've got a pretty big agenda coming your way for the rest of this year in 2013. What other projects you have coming up?
I actually have more of these event miniseries coming up. I'm doing two more of them in 2013, and they also cover big American historical topics. I'm going to do them in the same way using the partnership with Brainstorm with all the visual effects and trying to make the world as immersive as possible. I'm also doing other documentary series. I actually have another series premiering next week called Commander in Chief Inside the Oval Office, and it's looking at various military events through the president's eyes.
And I believe that is for one of Discovery Networks.
That is for the Military Channel, and really went and dug into our first episode that's airing on Thursday night at 10 is about the Cuban Missile Crisis coming up on the 50th anniversary, and really went and found as much uncovered as much new information as we could. We talked to people who were there in the room. We have amazing interviews. We got Robert F. Kennedy Jr. on there and other historians. But I think the most interesting thing about that was getting the people who were actually in the room while all these decisions were made.
At some point, do you think you will follow other people from nonfiction reality production companies and do some scripted programming?
I actually used to be a screenwriter for studios. And most of my screenplays did focus on true story dramas. So, I love scripted. I think I'm sort of in this genre that is coming up in television that's sort of a mix between scripted and non-scripted. I don't know if it's called docudrama. I don't know if it's called My agent calls it nonfiction fiction, but I think that it is an interesting wave to be a part of, which is, I think, yet to be defined, but mixes elements of movie making along with nonfiction.
And how widespread do you think this new genre may get?
That I know that I'm doing a few more of these types of things, and I think it depends, you know, how it feels to an audience. But I think that there are many nonfiction shows, many documentaries, many stories to be told that are true, and you know, I think what I'm looking into is are there other ways to tell their stories? Are there new ways using either storytelling or new technologies that sort of bring these stories out in a new way to audiences?
Do you think the genre is going to be helped by Lincoln, the new Steven Spielberg movie coming out next month? It had a premiere at the New York Film Festival several days back. The buzz has been widely ecstatic, from what I understand. And a lot of people are considering that the film and Daniel Day-Lewis' performance in Lincoln may be Oscar material.
I can't wait to see that film. I think that definitely has always been a genre within scripted that I've been fascinated with, just historical period pieces. I love them. So, and, you know, Spielberg is obviously great, and so is Daniel Day-Lewis. So those are always amazing things to watch. I think that there's what I'm looking at is there some way to, in nonfiction, to have some of the feeling of those types of films.
If you have a rare taste for how this country came to be, or you've never thought about some of the key people in the area of invention and finance and so forth, who built this country in the 1800s and 1900s, I think you're in for a great treat with the men who built America. I've seen some clips of the show, History Channel, starting at Tuesday night, 9:30 Pacific time. Check it out. I think you'll be really surprised, and I think you'll be really delighted with what Stephen has come up with the series. Again, Tuesday night, 9:30 Pacific time, on History Channel. Check your local listings for the cable or satellite place where it's in your area. And for more details about the show online, history.com. Stephen David, the executive producer of The Man Who Built America, thanks again for joining us. Great to have you aboard. Good luck with the project. I think it's going to be a winner, and hope to have you back soon.
Thank you so much for having me on, Simon.
It's a pleasure. Take care. Have a wonderful weekend.
You too.
Stephen David from The Man Who Built America, Tuesday 99 on History Channel. Monday on Tomorrow, we symbolize David Newberg from the Mortified Sessions on Sundance Channel, the husband and wife team from Flashpoint, creators Stephanie Morbenstein and Mark Ellis, and the writer and director of the new HBO film, The Girl, with Hughes and Julian General live from London. That's all Monday, 9th edition of Tomorrow Be Televised, right here on Blog Talk Radio. Next Friday, one of the producers of the new Nate Night sitcom with Scott Baio, CJ Run. And a week from Monday, we will have among our guests Linda Shire, the creator of Degrassi and the LA Complex, and Roa Bauer, the executive producer of the Golden Globe winning Emmy nominated Pillars of the Earth. Our new miniseries, World Without End, premieres next week on Radio's channel. Remember, you can catch us anytime on our homepage, www.blogtalkradio.com/SimonApple04. Email me with your thoughts about the program and your answers to our classic trivia question of the week, SimonApple04@Yahoo.com, SimonApple04@Yahoo.com. Love hearing from you, because as always, what you say matters. The views presented on this program are those of the participants, not necessarily those of Blog Talk Radio. Our production associate is John Sweet. For Tomorrow We'll Be Televised, I'm Simon Applebaum in New York. Thank you for listening. Have a wonderful weekend. We'll catch you Monday, 3 p.m. Eastern, Man Pacific, you know where, Blog Talk Radio. Until next time, stay well and stay tuned.
Judy was boring.
Hello.
Then Judy discovered Chumbacasino.com.
It's my little escape.
Now Judy's the life of the party.
Oh, baby, mama's bringing home the bacon.
Whoa, take it easy, Judy. The Chumba life is for everybody. So go to Chumbacasino.com and play over 100 casino-style games. Join today and play for free for your chance to redeem some serious prizes. Chumbacasino.com. No purchase necessary. Void where prohibited by law. 18 plus terms and conditions apply. See website for details.